Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, August 31st, 2008. This is show number 167. I've been traveling like crazy lately, just making me nuts. First, I had the New Media Expo in Las Vegas. Then I had that fantastic weekend in Virginia. Then this weekend, we took that little brat, Kyle, up to see Stanford and Berkeley as potential college choices, if he's smart enough. I really shouldn't call him a little brat. He's actually about 5'11", so, you know, there's that. There is a reasonable chance he just might make it into one of those two schools, surprisingly enough. Must be Steve's side of the family. You know, going in, I was really pushing for Berkeley, since it's about $20,000, including room and board, per year, but Stanford is $45,000 a year. Yikes. The two schools could not have been more different. Both old, established, well, old for the United States, Bart always laughs at me when I say old, but extremely established, highly ranked schools, you know, top 10 schools. But where Stanford is well-groomed and every building's architecture is identical, but beautiful, Berkeley is full of huge trees. They have the largest eucalyptus grove outside of Australia, and every building is completely different. I mean, just wild changes building to building. Berkeley's Telegraph Road is still staunchly in the 1960s, with hippie drug paraphernalia shops, used record stores, and the smell of incense in the air. Palo Alto, in contrast, the nearest town to Stanford, is very upper class, has a row of high-end stores, even has an Apple store. Kyle kidded around when we were over at Berkeley on Telegraph Road and said, "You aren't going to see an Apple store down here." I was actually a little frightened when I was walking in Berkeley at night, but I was assured that it's only that street, that it's not all the neighborhoods, and we walked a little further the next day and found out they were pretty much right. I did notice a big sign that said drug-free zone as we walked away from that scary street, and I'm thinking, what, is that just to tell us there's drugs behind us, but we're okay going this way? Anyway, it'll be interesting to see what he chooses and who chooses him. UCLA is going to be in the mix too, so I guess we better get around to checking out the one that's actually closest to our house. Well, I had a lot of fun this weekend. My daughter Lindsay is a maniac on taking photos and videos with her little digital camera. And the problem with the videos is they're AVI uncompressed video files, so they're huge. She's got, I don't know, 8, 10, 12 gig of just of the little videos that she takes at parties and things like that. And what'd she say, 16,000 photos. So she's pretty much burned through her 120 gig hard drive, and she had 300 megabytes left when she got home. So what I did was I ran a backup from her internal drive to, you remember me reviewing the IC dock I got from my friend Namdar, and I put that terabyte drive in that Honda Bob gave me, put it in there, and it's FireWire, right? So I did a full system backup over to the FireWire drive, and then I booted off the FireWire drive, verified that that worked, and the super duper backup is what I used to do the full backup. Then I took the drive out, and it is such a dream to take the drive out of a MacBook. If you think you're ever going to want to change your hard drive, don't buy a MacBook Pro. Just don't do it. Doesn't matter what other reasons you got, buy a MacBook. Swear to you, there's three little screws into a little L bracket. Well, first you pull the battery, three little screws. They're captive screws, so you can't even lose them. You undo those with a little teeny tiny Phillips screwdriver, pull those out, and then there's a little tab, and you pull it out, and that is the drive. That's it. That's pulling the drive out. Now, you do have to take it out of that carrier, and you need one of those, I can't remember the name of it. What are the, it's like a six-pointed, like a hex wrench, but it's not hex, it's like a star. Come on, chat room, what's the name of that? Anyway, somebody will tell me in a minute what those are called. But anyway, you have to take the drive off of that carrier, and then you put the new drive on, shove it, torque wrench. Thank you, Techno 5. There we go, torque wrench is what I meant. So you pop the new drive back in. I booted it up, and it booted off the external drive. And I opened up Super Duper from the external drive, told it to do a restore, walked away, and it did it. It was perfect. It was fine. So she's got a 250 gig hard drive in there. My clock time was probably 3 to 4 hours for the two complete transfers of 120 gig. But my actual time of me messing with it was like maybe 15 minutes tops. That's it. So it was really, really cool. That was pretty fun. I enjoyed that whole experience. Super Duper rocks. If you don't have Super Duper, go get it. Well, I asked my friend Jay the other day why he hasn't taken me out to lunch in like 9 months. And he said, Well, you're far too busy and important now, little Mrs. Podcastenstein. Isn't that a great name? From now on, I would like all of your emails addressed to me to begin with the phrase, Dear Little Mrs. Podcastenstein. That will do nicely, I think. In last week's Dumb Question Corner, I walked through all of the web gallery software and websites I've played with and in my walkthrough, I mentioned how I used to love the galleries in .Mac and how lame it was that with MobileMe, they took them away. As if there weren't enough things to complain about with MobileMe, they take away another service. Anyway, Connor contacted me this week to let me know that the galleries are not gone. They're just in a location where I never thought to look. I think if you were a regular, ardent user of the web galleries on .Mac before, it would not have been such a mystery to you. But I hadn't played with them since, last summer, so it didn't occur to me where they put them. It was actually fairly obvious. But I was looking in my me.com account. There's a tab there, a little picture of a yellow flower with a blue background, like the photo thing on the iPhone. And if you hover over that, it calls itself Gallery. For some silly reason, I thought galleries would be in, Gallery. Well, it turns out this is a place where you can view your albums, but in the upper right-hand corner, there's a link that says gallery.me.com/username, and that's where your pretty little galleries are. I also found out that in iPhoto, when you create the albums that later go up as galleries, it also shows the link to the galleries there. Thanks, Connor, for clearing that up. It sure seemed dumb that they got rid of it. Well, while we've had letters from Megan before, this time she sent in her very first audio review, and I think she did a fantastic job. Let's listen up.
Hi, Allison. This is Megan from Kansas, a.k.a. Not Nurse Ratchet. I listen to your podcast every week and have even had some dumb questions picked for Dumb Question Corner, but this is my first try at an audio review. I have listened with great interest to the ongoing dialogue regarding online photo sharing because I keep a lot of photos stored in various places online. Once I decided where to put all my photos, though, I faced another problem: how to easily look at other people's photos. I love the group pools on Flickr and the event photos that my friends post on Facebook, but I hate having to mouse all the time to page through them. I spent all my time clicking next, 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 and I am not a mouse fan. Finally, I found the solution for me: a free browser plugin called PicLens by Cool Iris. I'm sure you'll put a link in the show notes. After PicLens is installed, when you visit a PicLens-enabled site, of which there are many, including Flickr, Facebook, YouTube, and the other usual suspects, a funny icon that looks like two linked boxes will appear when you mouse over a picture or video. Click the icon and your media are swooshed into what the developers call a, quote, immersive view of the web, unquote. The media are displayed in several rows, and by rolling the mouse button, you control the size of the thumbnails. You can use the arrow keys to navigate side to side in the long stream of media. My favorite way to look at photos is to double-click. This loads a full-screen photo with thumbnails under it. You can navigate by using the arrow keys or click with the mouse to select the next full-screen photo. No matter how you use PicLens, though, gone are the days of paging through the screen after screen of tiny thumbnails, clicking and clicking to view media. It's hard to describe, so the best solution is to grab the plugin and give it a try. PicLens is free and works with Firefox 2 and 3 for Windows and Mac, Internet Explorer for Windows, and Safari. I don't have a fab phrase like happy computing, so I'll just say geek on. Thanks, and I love your show.
Well, I love anyone who loves my show. Why not? Megan, what a fantastic beginning audio recording. That was great. You stated the problem first. You know how I like that. You gave great examples of how and where it works. I'd heard of PicLens before, and I think I'd even installed it once at work, but I didn't even find any, sites that were interesting with it, so I got rid of it. I had never tried it on Flickr or Facebook. You know, we need something to make me like Flickr better because I can't stand that goofy little navigation tool. By the way, when I went hunting for the download, I discovered that it's not technically called PicLens anymore. Now they call it Cool Iris at cooliris.com. I found this interesting because I could have sworn that in the old days it was called Cool Iris Previews. I remember reviewing that a long time ago. So it sounds like they went Cool Iris, PicLens back to Cool Iris. It's easier to say PicLens, though, so maybe I'll keep calling it that. After listening to you describe it, I ran out and tried it again, and I put it onto Flickr and on Facebook, and it is fantastic. I love it. The only problem with doing it on Flickr is you find that you just get drawn into looking at people's photos because it goes through the photo stream kind of randomly of everybody you're following. And so I would see, you know, some beautiful castle taken by Bart and then some spectacular bird, a picture taken by Jane. And then I saw, you know, a picture of the harbor done by Rose. And then Elliot had this really awesome picture of a dock that he took at camp. And I was just, you know, 45 minutes later, I think this is a pretty bad tool. I'm not liking it. Anyway, it's just a really, really fun way to look at photos. Then I started playing around with it on Google Images, and that was really great. I went to enable Pick Lens on my website, but it turned out I have the wrong version of PHP on my website, and I thought, oh, no, this is going to be really hard. But I wrote to GoDaddy, and they said, oh, yeah, just click these buttons here, and you can upgrade your version of PHP. So when I get off my lazy butt and do that, you'll be able to run Pick Lens on my site. But then again, I don't put up very interesting pictures, do I? Just put up little images to go with what we're talking about. But it might be fun anyway. Well, if you enjoyed Megan's review, you might enjoy her blog over at notratchet.wordpress.com. Now, Not Nurse Ratchet is a reference to her profession. She is a nurse, but she goes by Not Nurse Ratchet online. Which, if you don't remember, or you're too young to remember, that was the evil nurse on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I still get the heebie-jeebies whenever I see Louise Fletcher in another movie or TV show after she played that part. Luckily, like I said, she is not Nurse Ratched, so maybe she's a nice nurse. I'm not sure. Her blog is a great read, and I mean with a tagline like healthcare, geekery, social media, and homepage-ish stuff, how could you go wrong reading that one? Well, listener, Elliot is back again, this time with an interesting review of two iPhone applications. Let's give him a listen.
Well, hey everyone, it's Elliot here. Today I'm going to talk about two pretty awesome iPhone apps that accomplish roughly the same problem. Did you ever hear that song at Starbucks or at the grocery store, but you can't quite figure out the name of it? It sounds so familiar and you know almost every word off by heart, but what was its name? Well, have no fear, for the iPhone is here. So, the first app that solves this problem that we all face is called Shazam. What an awesome name. So with Shazam, you hold your iPhone near a radio or a speaker or any other source of recorded music, and it listens for around 10 seconds. It then sends the clip to its database, and a few seconds later it will show you the song played, along with the artist, record label, and album. It's really quite like magic, it's incredible. So it even gives you a link to the song on YouTube, or at least a rendition of it. You can also add a photo to the tagged song and share the tag via email, which is a very nifty advertising scheme. And then you can save your tags so that you can view them later. I assume that would be why you could add photos to it, so that you can maybe add a photo to a song and then look at the tag later or for some other reason like that. So the other app that accomplishes this problem is called Madomi. While it doesn't have such an awesome name as Shazam, it does have a few extra features. Besides being able to listen to a song recorded on a CD or on the radio, it also allows you to sing, hum, speak, or type the song to it. I find the speaking and typing parts of the app a little pointless, as you could just go online and find the song, you know, on Google or something like that, if you already had the information. But however, the singing, humming part of the app is really quite amazing. So once you've ID'd a song, you can get links to it on iTunes, view videos on YouTube relevant to it, and possibly the coolest part of the app is that you can hear other people's rendition of the song. While this isn't always extremely high quality or anything like that, it sure is entertaining to hear other people's takes on a song. It will even let you hear them sing the part of the song that you recorded or sang yourself. So if you sang to Madomi, you know, the second verse of a song, you could hear the second verse sung by somebody else, so it's kind of cool how it does that. So now for my thoughts on the two apps. Shazam is awesome, but I prefer the interface and extra features of Madomi. However, Shazam works every time, whereas Madomi seems to have a weird "our servers are busy" error half the time. As far as tagging accuracy, both apps seem to be pretty spot on, although they won't always get the right album for the song in question. But, you know, that's kind of a hard thing to be able to figure out which version of a song goes with which album, so you can sort of forgive them for that. Shazam also says that their app is only free for a limited time, probably because of the silly fees they have to pay to record labels to be able to ID their songs, which I find kind of a little silly. obviously, because I just said that. But anyway, Modomi, on the other hand, makes no such statement on it having to be paid for anytime soon. So I would assume it's going to be free for, you know, the near future. So these two apps are truly amazing. They work just like magic. And best of all, they're both free from the App Store.
Well, thanks, Elliot. I love to get your reviews. I've played with both of these tools, and I agree that Modomi seems to have a server busy problem. When I first played with it, it was the first day of iPhone 2.0, and I thought maybe that was why I kept getting server busy, so I hadn't played with it in a long time. I thought it was just because everyone and their brother was singing into their iPhones that first day. I've pretty much been using Shazam since then. I think Shazam's consistency combined with a slick interface would be my pick if I had to choose. By the way, Elliot was nice enough to send in a couple of screenshots of each application, so go check those out in the show notes. If you guys have not got enough of Elliot here on the NoSillaCast, I do suggest you go over and subscribe to his videos on YouTube. He's always got an interesting tech experiment going on over there, which usually involves tearing apart some perfectly functioning piece of Mac hardware. I don't know what gets into that guy. Anyway, I put a link in the show notes to the Elliot Media Group videos so you can go watch for yourself. If you're a geek like me, you find yourself answering other people's Mac or Windows questions all the time. Or maybe you're somebody who just needs to show someone how to do things on a website. Perhaps you're a software developer who loves coding but hates writing documentation because it's so tedious. What if you could have a tool that allowed you to make simple screenshots, annotate them with the click of a button, even describe sequential steps on the same screenshot, and then have those instructive screenshots automatically formatted to sit nicely near text instructions you write. Never formatting, having to worry about bold or underlined or you know, page breaks or anything like that. What if that tool could also create PDF or HTML output to the web? What if you could post the instructions you've written to your blog post or page with a single click? What if this miracle software was only $40 for the standard edition or $60 for the pro version, but you actually got 25% off that price because you heard about it on the NoSillaCast podcast? That would be far too good to be true. By the way, have I been listening to too many infomercials lately? Anyway, that would be too good to be true. It would be a dream scenario. But shockingly, all of this is possible with ScreenSteps from ScreenSteps.com. They have a free 30-day trial if you're not sold just from my enthusiastic description, so there is no penalty to giving it a try. I have a true testimonial from my friend Andy McCaskey of the Slashdot Review podcast. I told him about ScreenSteps at the New Media Expo, and he checked it out right after the show was over. He sent me a tweet on Twitter right after he started using it that said, and I quote, 1 hour from cold start to professional output. So if you don't believe me, listen to Andy. He's never lied to you before. I mean, not that I've lied to you before, but come on, seriously. Once you've decided ScreenSteps is the tool to make your documentation woes go away and make you actually look forward to writing tutorials, click the link in the sidebar on podfeet.com for ScreenSteps and enter the coupon code NOSILLA, that's all capital letters, N-O-S-I-L-L-A, to get your 25% off. Well, Rod wrote in with his very first NoSillaCast review, and I think he did a fantastic job. He solved a real problem, and he does a great job of explaining the whole process. This one's kind of geeky, so sit back in your chair and pay attention.
About 16 hours ago, I was sitting at the International Terminal in Washington Dulles International Airport, bound for Frankfurt, Germany, by way of London Heathrow Airport. About 14 hours later, I checked into my hotel and arrived in my room. Upon checking into the hotel, I was given a username and password to access the hotel's Wi-Fi network. When I was in my room, I quickly plugged that information into my Windows laptop, and there I was on the Wi-Fi network. I then tried to plug the same information into my iPhone and into my MacBook Air. Unfortunately, the username and password only authorizes one MAC address to get on the hotel network. I called the front desk and begged for at least another username and password. Surely I had to get my MacBook Air on the network, but I was told it would cost me an additional 35 euros a day. There was no way I was willing to pay that, and I was more mad at myself because I forgot to bring my Airport Express with me on this trip. So there I was thinking, how can I trick the hotel's network to make it think that my MacBook Air is actually my Windows machine? And the first thing that came to mind was MAC address spoofing. So I was off to the races to try to figure out a way to get my MacBook Air on the hotel's network. I'm relatively new to OS X, and I haven't used Unix for the better part of a decade, but I know Windows like the back of my hand. So the first thing I did is jumped on my Windows machine and got to the command prompt and typed in ipconfig/all. This allowed me to get the MAC address on my wireless card in my Windows machine. I then popped over to OS X and opened up Applications, Utilities, Network Utility. I wanted to get the MAC address on my wireless card on OS X and verify whether it was EN1 or EN0. No shocker there, it had to be EN0 because I have a MacBook Air and we all know that doesn't have a built-in LAN card. Thanks a lot, Steve. Anyway, back to the topic. Once I got and verified that it was EN0 and got the MAC address, I knew that I had to jump down to Terminal. So I opened up one of my favorite old applications and got back to the command prompt. I remember a couple things from my Unix days, and I typed in ifconfig space EN0 space the pipe symbol grep GREP space ether ether and hit enter. That showed me the MAC address that was on my wireless card on my Mac. I then knew that it was a combination of the ifconfig command and elevating my rights. In the Unix world, I can do that by using the sudo command. So from the command prompt, I typed in sudo space ifconfig space EN0 space ether space, and then I typed in the MAC address for my Windows machine, something like xx:\xx:\. You kind of get the gif there. And then I hit enter. Unfortunately, the command failed, and I didn't know why. So I didn't even get prompted to elevate my credentials. And then it dawned on me. My wireless card is actually actively on and connected to the network. There's no way I can do this now. So I popped over and turned off the radio signal on the card. And I hit the up arrow, and the command appeared again, and I hit enter. Immediately, I was prompted for my admin password. I quickly gave it the admin password, and then I was just met with a command prompt again. So I hit the up arrow twice so I could go back to my original ifconfig EN0 pipe grep space ether command. When I hit that, I looked at the MAC address there, and I popped over and looked at my Windows machine again, and voila, my MacBook Air was now using the MAC address of my Windows machine. I quickly opened up Safari, and there I was surfing the network. For me, this was a massive relief because I typed hundreds of emails while I was in London Heathrow Airport, and there's no way I wanted to have to retype those again on my Windows machine, so they were off to the races. Why I carry two machines is just because I like to have my personal machine with me when I'm mobile, and I have to carry the other machine for work because that's how I make my money. But the really cool thing about it was even though the hotel had such a silly policy only allowing one machine on the network, I was able to trick it and get my MacBook Air on the network to communicate. There might be somebody else out there who has to travel for work and runs into these absolutely arcane policies at our hotel, or sometimes you're there with a friend and they've already gotten on the network and you'd like to steal their connection for a couple minutes for free to send a couple emails. This got me through one of the dark times sitting in a hotel room late at night in Germany, and hopefully it'll help somebody else out. Allison, I love your show, and I actually even created a screen steps for everybody, just in case someone thought this might be useful and wanted to use it. Yet another application that I bought, and I absolutely love it. So if I keep listening to all these Mac shows, I'll probably have more Macs in my house and more applications from Allison. Thanks a lot, and enjoy.
Rod, this is a fantastic tip. I have definitely had this happen to me before. I've plugged in one computer and not been able to use the other one, so I will definitely be using this sometime in the future. I was talking to the folks in the chat room here on Ustream, because remember, we are live on Ustream on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. GMT-8. Anyway, I was talking to the guys in the chat room about this this tip that Rod gave, and Kenny said he had the same problem where he plugged in one computer, they wanted to charge him for the second one. Somebody else said they had it with a VM where they were going to have to pay for the second VM to get on. Well, that's stupid. Well, anyway, for those of you who were furiously trying to write down the Unix commands Rod used, have no fear. He actually wrote up show notes that included all of the commands in Unix, so you've got a permanent place to go look this up when you need it. Great audio on your recording, too, Rod. Speaking of great audio from a brand new contributor, William from upstate New York sent in a review of Scrabble on the iPhone that I think you'll enjoy, too. Just a teeny bit lighter topic.
Hi, Allison. This is William from upstate New York. Doing my first review, my first audio review. This is something new for me, so hopefully this will come out all right. But anyway, moving on, the application that I'm going to review here is an iPhone or iPod Touch application, and it is the classic game of Scrabble, and it's from Electronic Arts, and you can find that in the App Store. Basically, it's the traditional or classic game of Scrabble, and it has several game modes. You can play against the computer or your iPhone, I guess, if you consider that a computer. And when you play against the computer, there are several difficulty levels. You can also play against up to three friends. And this is something that I've actually really enjoyed with my wife and my son. And what you do is you take your turn, and then when you're finished, you just pass the phone or the iPod over to the next person, and then they take their turn and so forth. And we've kind of had a good time with that. It's kind of enjoyable sometimes when you maybe have a few minutes and you just have nothing to do, you're waiting or whatnot. It's a fun little game to play. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to mention, when you're playing against the computer, there are several difficulty levels. I think there are three. And a word of advice, I tried playing against the computer on the hard level, and it, you know, the computer comes up with words that are quite advanced. I quickly realized how many words I didn't know and how poor of a Scrabble player I really was, because the computer comes up with, you know, 7 or 8 letter words versus my 3 letter words. But anyway, you can adjust the difficulty level. And as far as the use of the device features, a few things to note that you can zoom in and out real easily with the touch feature of the phone by double tapping or doing the pinch gesture. You can also shuffle the letters on your tray by just shaking the iPhone. It kind of moves them around. Maybe you want to look at your own letters in a slightly different arrangement. And you can also drag and drop the letter tiles onto the board. Now, speaking of the zooming in, obviously the board itself is kind of small on an iPhone, but the zoom feature is quite nice, and it's very easy to see the board, where the triple letters and double words and all those special squares are on the board. Regarding the sound is quite good. It's got very good sound effects. It's got background music, which you can disable if you find that annoying. You can also adjust the volume of both the music and the sound effects of the game. Another interesting feature that it has this feature called Best Word, and what that does is essentially if you kind of feel like you're stuck or you're maybe way behind in the game, it's kind of a little cheat. Each player is given 4 of these. They're these little hearts, and when you play one of those, the computer will basically generate the best possible play for you, and then you have the option of either taking that or not. So again, it is kind of a cheat, but it kind of is fun as well. If you are in a game where you're way behind, it'll come up with a 30-point play or whatnot. And again, you know, obviously you don't have to use that, but it is there. The game also keeps track of statistics. So as you play different games against the computer, it will keep track of your things like your best single play or your most points you ever earned for a word, the wins and losses, your win-loss rate against the computer. And so that's kind of a nice feature. You can try to, you know, beat your prior scores. A couple things on things that I'd like to see improved on the game for the future is sometimes the computer will play words and I have no idea what they are. And maybe I'm on the bus or on the plane or whatnot and don't really have access to a dictionary. And so it would be nice if you had the ability to look up words within the game. I'm sure there are probably dictionary applications you can get at this point for the iPhone. You know, but it would be nice if it was right there and handy with the game. And then the only other one that I wanted to mention was that at any point in time, you can only have one game going. In other words, if you're playing a game, maybe with some friends, and you don't get to complete it, you'll have to abandon that game to start a new game, say, against the computer or against another group of people. So you can't have multiple games going or sort of save games. But the game you do have going will, I guess, when you relaunch the app, it's still there and waiting, and you have the choice to either abandon that game or continue with it. The application itself is $9.99 at the App Store. I think it's been up for quite a while now, but I just felt it was a great app. I've had a lot of fun with it and thought others might as well. So thanks a lot. Love your show. Tune in every time and keep up the great work. Thanks a lot.
William, I am so your people on Scrabble. I like the game, but if I get like a three-letter word, it's time for a high fives around the room for me. Thank goodness for me, they have a mode to help me, too. That sounds like something I need. I love the idea of shaking the iPhone to scramble the letters in the tray. Wish I had that on the real Scrabble. Well, it's great to let you to know that they let you turn the sounds off, too. Sometimes it's cute for a while to have sounds, but then you just want to play during a staff meeting or something like that, and it's considered poor form to have the sound on during staff meetings, you know. Hey, you gave a really nice balanced review, I think, by explaining what you did like about it and what you'd improve if you could ask the developers. I really appreciate your time to that you took doing this review. Megan, Rod, and William have all done a great job of setting the bar really high on audio quality for the first-time reviewers. And for really good, well-thought-out, and organized content. I like the way they each walk through the problem and what problem they solved, and even if the thing to be solved was just, entertainment on your iPhone. If any of the other listeners are out there itching to do an audio review, use these as great examples of the ones I like to play. And now, for something completely different. I am going to do an actual review myself. Now that everyone else is doing all the work, I haven't had to do one of my own in ages. One of the big rages all these days is to create mind maps. These are a way of piling your ideas on a subject into little thought blobs connected by lines on a page, and it helps you understand what you know, or maybe to figure out what you don't know. It's a way of organizing your thoughts. You just kind of fling them out there, and you can drag them around and make sense out of them. It's kind of hard to explain if you haven't played with one, but I bet you have because they're all the rage. Well, first of all, there's Mind Manager from MindJet.com. It costs $349 and is well accepted in corporate environments. That's a lot more money than my limited skill set and need for this kind of tool warrants. Since I thought that was a little too much, I've been using an open source mind mapping application called FreeMind from freemind.sourceforge.net. I've been using it for a little over a year, and I did a full review of it back when I started using it, and I really like it. Like I said, I'm not a power user by any means, and much of the mind mapping process remains a mystery to me, but it still has helped me to sort out comments on a survey, for example. One thing I really like is that FreeMind will create a Java web page so that you can send the mind map out to people who don't have the tool and don't want to look at a teeny little tiny display of a PDF file with a zillion little bubbles on it. Instead, they get a bunch of boxes, kind of color-coded if you create your mind map that way, and you have little plus signs next to them that'll flip down to expand and contract the children of those bubbles. Makes it kind of a nice way to share your brilliant ideas. One thing I really don't like about FreeMind is that it's very tedious to apply color coding and font changes to the little bubbles. You have to right-click, drag over two levels of menus just to set the background color of an item. No nice little color palette button like most programs. It's also a little annoying to make new children of a bubble. The sub-bubbles are called children. So what you have to do is hover over the parent first, and then it turns gray, and then you hit enter. But sometimes it doesn't work, so you don't get the gray when you hover over it, so you click on the parent. But that collapses the parent, so you have to click again to open it back up. Probably just doing something wrong, but that's what happens to me frequently. Well, anyway, Ben recently told me about MindNode, which is also free from MindNode.com. So I thought I'd check it out to see if it's easier to work with. Now, FreeMind is Java-based, so it runs under Windows, Linux, and Mac operating systems, which you know I like. But MindNode is only written for the Mac. As much as I like and support open tools that run on every platform, the result is that often you get an application that's not Mac-like. Things don't behave as expected. Sort of like how things weren't quite normal in FreeMind and you know, its ability to do little colors. It could be that MindNode would be more Mac-like, so I decided to give it a try. The MindNode website describes a few distinguishing features that sounded really good to me. First of all, new nodes are created by simply dragging them out of the node wells. There's no need to access the toolbar or the application menu. Secondly, the very simple and intuitive interface lets the user focus on finding and developing ideas. Nearly no time is required to learn the interface. Number three, the ability to create multiple mind maps on one canvas makes MindMap an ideal tool for brainstorming sessions. And fourth, they say you can print, share, and export your mind map as TIFF images, FreeMind, PDF, HTML, or OPML documents. Well, it was time to give MindNode the NoSilicast test. When I first launched MindNode, I liked it immediately because it is just about as simple as you could possibly hope for in an interface. There's literally nothing on the screen other than the starting bubble. I started typing, and it replaced the words in the starting bubble just like I'd hoped. And that's when it got really fun. Next to the bubble, a little plus sign came on screen. Click that, and you get a new node. Which, by the way, I guess is the official name for what I keep calling the little bubbles or blobs. That little plus sign made it so easy to make new nodes. My node is also animated, so as the node shows up, it sort of grows out of the parent, which was really fun to look at. I created a few children and subchildren, and they worked okay. But then they started kind of getting tangled on top of each other, the subchildren of one node being kind of messed on top of the subchildren of another node. Then I realized you could just drag the nodes anywhere you want, and the little tails that connect them just follow them around. This kind of feature will definitely be a preference for you, whether you like it or not. The beauty of the other mind mapping programs like Mind Manager and FreeMind is they don't let you spend any time fooling around with formatting like that. They rearrange the nodes so that they always stay clean looking. On the other hand, if you're a control freak like me, you can find it a bit irritating that you don't have much choice of overriding their decisions. You can take a node and move it entirely by dragging all of its children along, or you can take a child and drag it to reassign it to a new node, but you can't really change how they look within a node structure. For a control freak like me who likes to format things rather than spend time actually creating valuable content of real work of any kind, I would prefer the way my node works. Well, I ran the acid test on my node. I clicked on a node and I tried to figure out how to change the color. There's a grand total of 3 icons on the menu bar in my node: Inspector, Colors, and Fonts. Yay! I clicked on Colors, and there's the standard Mac color palette. And it stayed up for me, too, so I could click around and format a bunch of nodes. I didn't have to do any pull-down of menus that was so annoying on FreeMind. One thing I forgot to mention on FreeMind, when you do drill down those 3 menus deep to change the color of a node, you're met with a massive grid of colors where it's really hard to tell which red is the normal red. And it's not easy to find the exact same one you used on the previous node you colored red. They try to help you by having the latest used colors in another grid, but if you poked around a bit trying to find the right one, those are all in there too in the latest used grid. My node is much easier for culling for sure. I wanted to find a way to put a hard carriage return in a node. You know, let's say you wanted to put in a whole sentence in a node, but it would be 18 feet long on the page and it would look really stupid. In FreeMind, you have to right-click on it, select Edit Long Node, and then you get a node editing window where you can put in hard carriage returns, and then you can click OK. In my node, I figured out that if you just hold down Control-Alt when you hit the carriage return, it forces the carriage return for you. I found that just by experimenting around because I know that works in Microsoft Excel, and I thought maybe I'd get lucky, and I did in my node. My node, unlike all the other options, allows you to create more than one mind map on a page, and I think that could come in really handy. There's been times I wanted just a blob of stuff off by itself. I created a mind map, and then I ran the export command to test out making an RTF, an HTML, an OPML, and a PDF version of it. I put them all up on the web so you can view them if you like. The RTF and HTML are both really clean bulleted lists showing indents on the style. And the PDF looks just like the screen in my node. I do need to figure out a way to read OPML documents, though, because it just looks like a bunch of markup language when I pull it up in Safari or Firefox. Could have sworn I had something that would read OPML. Maybe somebody in the chat room will remind me what OPML gets opened in while we're talking here. Anyway, I think my node will be my mind mapping tool of choice for now, because until I find something it can't do, I really like the way it works. Thanks for a great recommendation, Ben. What kind of car do you drive? Is it a Honda or an Acura? If it isn't, and you live in the LA or Orange County areas, may I most politely suggest that you go out right now and sell your car to somebody else. Then go out and buy a Honda or Acura so you can just use Honda Bob as your mechanic. What are you waiting for anyway? I've done over 60 advertisements for Honda Bob and you still don't have a Honda? You know, I told my friend Amy about Honda Bob, and every time she has him over to her home and he slaves away on her car while she relaxes or gets something constructive done, she sends me a happy little thank you note. It's so nice to be able to recommend someone you know won't let people down, you know will give a fair price, and you know will stand behind his work. That's Honda Bob in a nutshell. So if you do have the right kind of car and do live in the area where he services those lucky enough to have him stop by, give him a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com. If you want to read up on articles he's written about cars, interesting stories of his auto-related adventures, check out his website at hdabob.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide. It's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz of bartbouchatz.ie. How are you doing today, Bart?
I'm good, although I'm a little confused. There's this strange yellow thing in the sky which has got this funny blue color. I don't know what's going on.
Ooh. Have you called the news or anything to see what that is?
I'm surprised it didn't make headlines, actually. No, it's been an absolutely fantastic afternoon. I was out in my shorts and T-shirt taking photographs of butterflies. And for the first time in my life, I saw a Red Admiral and managed to get a picture of it. Well, I think I did. I haven't actually downloaded my photographs yet, but I'll do that this evening.
Is that a type of butterfly?
It's a type of butterfly that's huge. I mean, you know the way they say butterflies come in different sizes, but I had no idea that this thing, if its wingspan is about the width of my hand.
Oh, really?
Because I saw it from miles away, and then I saw it land on a wall and ran over to it with a big 200mm lens, and then proceeded to sit there and do nothing for about 3 minutes, which was fantastic.
Well, that was lucky. Maybe he was tired after such a big wingspan.
Yeah, but he sat there for ages, and then he went and conveniently sat on a flower for a while, and then he set it off very quickly.
Wow. It looks like, I'm looking at pictures now, they look like monarchs.
Yeah, they're mainly black, and then they have these red stripes, which are meant to look like the stripes in an admiral's uniform or something. I think that's where the name comes from. Okay. They're very beautiful, and I can now testify to that in real life.
Huh. Cool. Yeah. Well, let's see. We had a couple of good topics today. One of the things we've been discussing is the fact that we've been a little bit on the serious side with all of this security talk all this time. So this week we're going to argue about a movie. You put up a terrible post saying that you did not like the latest Indiana Jones movie. What's wrong with you?
I believe the title I gave it was Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the God-Awful Movie.
Which I think sums it up. Movie. I thought it was so much fun, except for the part in the middle where I fell asleep. I thought it was really, really good.
It started so good. You know, as you get, you know, the car pulls up, you see the hat come out, and then you see the shadow of him putting on the hat, and the music is building up, and you think, oh my God, he's still got it. He may be 60 years old, but it's still indie. fantastic, you know, and
great
they
opening.
Really captured the 50s. Fantastic opening. You had to turn off the science part of your brain pretty soon in, but I was happy enough to do that. It's an indie film. You don't go to it for realism. But what I can't stand, no matter, I mean, you know, willing suspension of disbelief I have always done for Indiana Jones films, but not willing suspension of logic and continuity and, you know, consistency, because that just doesn't work. There's only so far your brain can stretch until it explodes. And I actually remember the exact moment when it exploded. Because I was watching
that?
It with a friend. Okay, so the whole start of the film, you see this. These things are insanely magnetic. You know, they're attracting gunpowder from
what's
halfway
magnetic?
Across.
What's magnetic?
The crystal skulls.
There
the crystal
go.
Skulls.
And just for anybody who hasn't seen it, right?
Yes, we must spoil it completely. so, you know, halfway across the warehouse, these things are attracting gunpowder, which I didn't even know was magnetic and probably isn't, but we'll skip over that. And then they're attracting the big BB pellets inside shotgun cartridges. And
that was a great scene. That was really fun.
Yeah, as I say, I turned the physics part of my brain off and let it go. And then, like, she looks at it and her glasses come shooting off her face and stick to it. And I thought, that was cool.
Sure.
And the crowbars get stuck to it. So, you know, the message here is quite clearly these things have insane magnetism.
Right.
And then when they find the other skull, they find it because coins start magically going over to it.
Okay.
And then they rip away the dead body and find the skull underneath. So, you know, the magnetism thing is pretty big. It's a pretty major thing. Then, later in the film, they're driving along through a forest with two parallel cars driving perfectly in parallel while having a sword fight with each other. And I said to the friend, what?
That was fun?
It was fun. Shia LaBeouf may never have children because of the thistles, but we'll leave that aside. And, you know, they're fighting away with these giant big swords. Exactly why they were fighting with swords, I have no idea, but there we go.
Well, weren't they on tanks or something, too? Or, I guess it was armored vehicles.
Well, they were actually DKUWs or ducks.
Oh, ducks? Were they ducks?
They were ducks because they jump off waterfalls with them later.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Remind me to tell you a story about the ducks when we're done arguing about this.
Okay. So anyway, they're fighting away in the ducks and they're having a sword fight. And I says to my mate, I says, where's the skull? And he went, oh, it's right next to them. What? What do you mean it's right next to them? Why aren't their swords sticking to it? Why has the magnetism suddenly ceased to exist?
Well, why isn't the skull sticking to the side of the truck itself, right?
Yeah, the truck, the skull, the guns, the knives, the swords. It was having no effect on any of the insane amount of metal all around. And this goes on for ages. At that point,
but they had it wrapped in a cloth.
Ah, but of course, yeah, the giant big crate and the wrapping and the dead body and the shroud, that couldn't stop the magnetism, but that little bag could. And then they have Shia LaBeouf swinging faster than cars and all sorts of ridiculousness, and it just goes downhill horribly fast from there.
Is Shia LaBeouf the girl?
No.
Which one's Shia LaBeouf?
Indy Jr.
Oh, okay, right. Okay, now see the only part I really had trouble with was there was some skull hypnotism scene, and I guess it hypnotized me or something because I fell sound asleep during that part. Had a nice little nap, woke up, and I liked the rest of the movie.
Okay, I think you may have missed some of the worst bits of it then.
Oh.
No, honestly, from as soon as that, my brain actually just snapped at that point, and I realized that these guys had just sold out. Like, you know, an amateur with a camcorder making a film would have better consistency than that. And, you know, for some of the best filmmakers of all time to come out with some junk like that, it strikes me of they just have their hand out for some more money, please, thank you. And people gave it to them. I mean, you know, indie one-liners are very important. He reused the same one-liner twice in the one film.
Which line was that?
So I don't like the look of that or something to that effect. Or I can't remember the exact line, but it was, you know, something like that. Oh, I don't like the look
time,
of that.
Huh?
It was, yeah, the first time it was nice. It was sort of a little chuckle moment. Oh, that line again. Okay, we've had that in other films, but fair enough. And then he used it again in the same film. I was like, ah, come on. You know, and then the soundtrack. I am a gigantic fan of John Williams. He has written some of the music that gets more stuck in my head than any other music on the planet. But nothing. It's as if he just phoned in his contribution. There was nothing at all memorable in the soundtrack. Apart from the fact that it occasionally slipped into the theme for the Ark from Raiders of the Lost Ark. That was it.
Yeah, you're right. There was definitely not any great music that left you, you know, humming as you walked out or to remember that would be the epic song. But, you know, it is, what, the fourth film or something like that? Do you really have that high expectations for the fourth film?
There's years between them. I mean, they're all getting old. This is the last one they're going to be able to do. So I was hoping it would go out with a bang. I was hoping that this would be one last hurrah and, you know, Indy rides again. Put all your effort into it because it's not going to happen again. And honestly, and then by the time we got to the fairy tale ending at the end...
Don't spoil the ending. I love the ending.
That had me gagging. And then as the door blows... The door magically blows open and the hat rolls in. It's like, oh, for God's sake.
But it could have gone much... They could have done much worse with that ending. There were a lot of predictions I had in my head of what they would do. And I was like, oh, this is going to suck. And then I liked the way they did it. I thought it was a good ending. Did you at least like the fight scene in the 1950s, 60s bar?
That was fun. No, actually, one thing I will say is they did a fantastic job of capturing the essence of the 50s. I mean, that was fantastic.
Well, that's good.
And the cinematography at the start, like, literally the first 10 or 15 minutes had me going, oh, wow, oh, wow, and then it just went... I think it all when they nuked the fridge, it all went downhill.
Oh, come on, that's a bad pun there.
It's actually apparently in film circles become a new term for selling out.
Well, all downhill, but downhill when you nuke the fridge. Remember, he rolls down the hill in the fridge. I thought that was funny too.
I actually quite enjoyed the little gophers that kept popping up and stuff. Which a friend of mine who's a giant indie fan, I think he described the first time he saw it as watching his childhood be raped.
Oh God, that's terrible. Wasn't that bad? I guess I don't know. No. One thing I did think about afterwards was that it just reminded me of a Mummy film. You know,
that's not a compliment.
Right, exactly. But I love those movies. I like it's real silly. Well, hey, we were only supposed to talk about this for a couple of minutes just to give a little, you know, cleansing of the palate from all the security talk. We've been arguing this week about iChat versus Adium. The new Adium 1.3 came out that adds the capability to talk in Facebook chat. So I've been playing with it and really enjoying it. But one of the reasons you go for it is because you hate iChat, and I want to hear why.
I hate iChat with a fiery passion. I think it is the most un-Apple-like product I have yet to come across in the Apple line of products.
Well, that might be there's a nothing in, with Mobile Me out there.
No. Well, compared to Mobile Me, I suppose. But its core job is to be a chat client. I mean, you can't take away from the fact that the screen sharing is fantastic, and that's the only thing I use iChat for, is just screen sharing and that's it. But its core job is to be a chat client. That's what it needs to do really well. Now, in my case, the reality is that no chat protocol is ever going to take over the world, so we're all going to need multi-protocol chat clients. So we need a chat client that handles multi-protocols well, multiple conversations well, and that's just easy to see what's going on.
Well, now, hang on. iChat does Mac.com, AIM, and Google Talk, and Jabber. So it is a multi-chat chat client. It may not have the ones you want, but it is a multi-chat chat client.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not multi-chat. What I'm saying is it doesn't handle the multi-chat very well. On IBM, you have one single contact list. On .Mac, you have one for every protocol. Because clearly, having lots of windows cluttering the place is obviously a much better solution.
Well, wait a minute. You're saying if you have somebody on Google Talk, they would be in a separate physical window?
No, I'm talking about the Who's Online things.
Right.
So I have two protocols set up in my AIM, and I get two windows with two lists of people who are online.
You mean in your iChat?
Okay. In IG.
Okay, yeah, but Adium mashes them together, so I can't tell which protocol you're coming from. Maybe I don't care.
Well, I certainly don't care. And actually, there's an option to have it display the user's icon and the service icon. But I honestly don't care how I'm talking to you. What I care about is who I'm talking to. And I want to have a look in one place and see, is Allison online? Not scan through one list and then scan through another list and then scan through another list.
Well, I see you twice in Adium. I see you on ICQ and I see you on .Mac.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
But you don't have to go looking in three places to see if I'm on anywhere.
Hmm. Okay. I hadn't noticed there were extra windows. I'll have to look at that. What else?
The other thing that drives me absolutely insane is on Adium... Okay, iChat and Adium both let you have multiple tabs within the one window, which is really handy because I don't like having lots of chat windows. I like to have them all in the one window and just have them tabbed. I want my chat client to sort of sync away out of view. But in Adium, I can see in the tabs whether or not someone is online. They have a little green circle next to their name if they're online. They have a gray circle next to their name if they're offline, a red circle if they're away, and a yellow circle if they're idle. Exceptionally handy. So if I'm chatting to you, I don't have to go look to a different window to see what your status is. I just come back to the window where I haven't talked to you in maybe 3 or 4 hours and look, oh, Allison's online, chat away, rather than find the chat window, then have to go find the status window and hunt for you and go, oh yeah, Allison is online.
I guess I close my chat windows when I'm done talking to someone. I don't keep it open, so I wouldn't use that maybe as much. If you go offline right while I'm talking to you, I guess it's handy for that. But I tend to look at my buddy list first. Maybe I'm trained to do that because it doesn't show me in the chat window, though.
Yeah, I don't think you have any choice, really. I have the same about 10 tabs open all the time, about the 10 people I talk to most often. I scan along the bottom and, you know, just see what the story is.
That's an interesting way to go. Okay.
The other thing is that stupid bubble, those silly talk bubbles, they waste so much space. I want small, compact little chat client that just sits out of my way instead of these gigantic big bubbles that achieve nothing but look silly. Now, I admit that's completely a taste thing, but I find them horribly distasteful.
Well, you could do a lot to change the fonts and colors and things like that to mute it down, I suppose, but you probably can't make the chat bubble smaller.
Yeah, and it's the size I want. I hate things that take up too much space. Screen real estate is precious, and you shouldn't just take it up needlessly for me being bubbly. And I also don't think it makes conversations particularly easy to read back through, especially not in group chats.
Hmm. Well, you get different colored bubbles by the group chat. That's kind of handy.
Yeah. Adium does that kind of thing, too.
Right, right. You do have a lot more...
But much more compact.
You have a lot more control, too, about the look and feel of Adium, I think.
Yeah, I actually just use default Adium. I don't actually go changing things. But if you want to, you can, to an insane degree, to what I call the open source degree, where it's actually, I think, too high of a degree, where you could actually spend your entire day from morning till night customizing Adium. That's, I'd like to be chatting.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that I do right away is Steve just started using Adium, and I notice every single time anyone comes on or goes off, it makes a noise. Well, I need to change that right away. So I would definitely not go with the defaults.
Okay.
You must have flicked that one off early on.
I possibly did, actually. The nice thing, actually, is I've been using Adium since version 1.something. Since 0.8 or 0.7, I think, actually. Sorry. And it's kept my settings with me the whole way through, which is really nice, actually.
Now, you haven't mentioned the fact that Adium crashed on you about 7,246 times this year.
It had this bizarre thing, and it only happened on G5 Max. No, it didn't happen on G4s, it didn't happen on Intels. It was a G5 only thing. And it was for one version, so I think it was from 1.1 to 1.2 or something. It was just that gap.
That was a long revision, though.
It was a long revision, and it drove me absolutely insane. And the main reason I know I hate iChat so much is because Adium's issues on the G5 forced me to use iChat for a month or more. That was enough to drive me utterly demented.
This sounds a little bit like everybody hates how much Twitter goes down, and yet we keep going back to it.
It does, but the thing is, I had been an Adium user for years, and it was always solid. Then it went through a couple of months of a very, very rough patch on the G5s, and it's been rock solid ever since. So you can't quite compare it to Twitter.
Which is a little unfair. No, I meant, but people don't leave it, even though it's a dodgy system. But, I'm intrigued with your thing about screen real estate. On the Twitter topic, a lot of people are talking about TweetDeck, and I put that thing on, and it's 3/4 of my screen is covered with chat stuff.
Yeah, as soon as I heard the description of TweetDeck, I went, okay, not for me.
I mean, on a 15-inch screen, you're literally talking close to half of the screen real estate, I think. I should take a screen snapshot of it. It's ridiculous.
I think Don McAllister dedicates an entire space to it in Spaces.
Yeah, he was talking about that on his show, yeah.
So if you do it that way, I suppose it's tolerable that you just move into that space, but I'm not that obsessed with Twitter to need that.
No, definitely not.
And that's actually one of the things I like about the Twitter client I do use, Twirl. It's one of the more compact ones.
Yeah, I'm enjoying that. I'm playing around with Spaz right now, too, just to see what it can do. But it doesn't appear to have a snip URL button, which makes it kind of clumsy for putting links in and stuff.
Has Spaz changed much? Because both of us actually looked at Spaz way back at the start of Twitter. We actually did a chit-chat across the pond about it.
Yeah, I looked to see why we didn't like it, and so I'm looking to see if it's still got those features. It seems pretty clean. Very, very pretty. Very pretty. Really like the look of it.
It used to be ugly brown.
Well, yeah, it is ugly brown, I think. Or stark black.
If it's pretty, then it's obviously changed somewhat, because I would never have described the version I tested as pretty.
Well, pretty might be what I think pretty is, though.
I don't remember you calling it pretty either back then.
Oh, back on the chat client thing, I can tell you there's a way worse client. We use Lotus Same Time at work.
It's got the word Lotus in it.
Well, no, Lotus isn't all bad. Now, don't get down on them. They're moving a lot towards open standards. Their products are...
It's not the functionality in Lotus that's bad. It's the UI. Lotus have had this fascination with non-standard UI elements for as long as they've existed, and it drives me potty.
But don't lump all things Lotus Notes under Lotus. Okay, so Lotus has a lot of things in it now. Like, they've got their Lotus Connection software that's all web-based, all open standards, definitely runs on Windows and Mac. All of their client software runs on Windows and Mac, but I believe the later stuff now they're working on runs on Linux as well. So if you compare to Microsoft, they're heading definitely in the right direction. I mean, Lotus Notes is still an abomination, but the thing that's making me crazy right now about Lotus Same Time is it's a chat client. And so let's say somebody chats me something and I write back to them, and then I click over and I'm typing an email. If they chat back, that window pops up and whatever I was typing now starts getting typed into that window. And it drives me nuts, because I have to go erase it, click back into my mail, I start typing again, and they chat me another sentence and my words start getting typed in there again. It's driving me nuts. It's really rude.
Whoever wrote that obviously never, ever, ever used the software for 5 minutes.
I'm thinking. Well, you had a phrase for that about self-important software. That's what it was.
Yeah, it's like, I demand your attention now.
Exactly.
No, no, you don't. I'm in charge, not you.
Well, I think that wraps up our discussion of why you think iChat sucks, but I still really like iChat. I mean, the video chat works extremely well, not as good as Skype, but for a lot of people, I don't want to scare them and try to talk the whole Skype thing. You know, let them come along slowly and do iChat with them first, and the screen sharing is just outstanding.
Screen sharing is fantastic. There is nothing to rival it, which is why iChat gets fired up about once every month or so. I don't screen share often, but if I do, it's iChat because it just works. So that's fantastic. But in terms of it as a chat client, I don't like it. And if I wanted to talk to someone, I wouldn't do a voice chat over iChat because Skype has better compression by the sounds of things. It seems to deal with the less bandwidth more efficiently. And the two of us actually ages ago did a test of video. And I think we found that Skype's codecs were way more efficient and could work through crappier bandwidth with less issues as well.
Definitely. And the tests I did with Lindsay across to Italy were, it was 3-1. You know, Skype was much, much better quality over iChat for its video compression. So I agree with that. But there's a lot of people that you're not going to be able to talk into loading Skype that might, you know, be a lower end Mac user. Sometimes it's nice to just be able to chat with them in that.
It's nice that it's there from scratch. So that you have that way of helping people without a giant, big stumbling block. And also stuff like iChat Theater for giving presentations remotely. That's all very cool. So the non-chat bits of iChat are actually quite good. But in terms of actual day-to-day chatting, which, you know, if you look at my usage of, you know, an iChat-like program, it's 99.999% just talking to people in
That's
text.
True.
And then 0.1% is the rest.
Definitely.
So I don't mind loading up iChat for the rest every now and then, but I would never use it for day-to-day chatting. It just, you know, it works, but compared to Adium, it's just not in the same league. It's like IE7 works, but compared to Firefox...
Oh, come on. It's not. It's nowhere near that comparison. IE7's horrible.
It is in my head, actually. I actually would put them exactly in the same league as comparisons goes. It has all the features. It has tabs. Has everything you could want.
But the UI is
horrible.
Terrible. Oh, come on. It's not that bad. How much have you used IE7?
Minimally.
Okay. I have to use it like 3 or 4 times a week, and it's gruesome. I can never find anything. I can't. Not 3 or 4. It's probably 3 or 4 times a day I have to fire it up at work. It's horrible. It's horrible. It's unusable.
Well, that's how I feel about iChat.
You're just wrong. And on that note, since I have the stop button, I'm going to call it a day here.
Okie dokie. Until next time, happy computing.
Wow, that was a full show. And get this, I pushed both Jane and Donald's review off until next week. That's great news, though, that I have those in the can because I will be attending the demo conference in San Diego next Sunday and Monday, so the schedule for the show is going to be a bit accelerated. I doubt I'll be able to do a live show. If I do, it's going to be some mutant time like Saturday afternoon or Sunday morning. But for future weeks, be sure to check out ustream.tv/nosilicast for the live show, which is normally around 5 p.m. GMT-8. It's a lot of fun in there. People mock me, correct my mistakes live, and they get to talk to each other, which I think is a lot of fun. If you want to send in a comment, suggestion, dumb question, corner question, or even an audio review of your own, shoot those off right away to nosilicast@gmail.com. You know I love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.